You could also see what's happening with the Ismailis in Fatimid Egypt, in Fatimid North Africa. Very similar idea of quite a centralized, quite hierarchical system in which ultimately it was the Imam who was making decisions, and people had certain authority because they were conveying what the Imams were saying, conveying what the Imam's teachings were. But a lot of that still needs to be filled in. Arguably, still, there hasn't been a huge amount of work done on the elements of the social history of that period, of exactly how people lived, you know, where communities were. Some of it's quite well done. For example, we know about Iran, where communities were, because people have written volumes on it, and we have the sources. We know about it for certain parts of what is now Iraq. But we don't know very much about Yemen, and we don't know a huge amount, surprisingly, even about Medina in terms of how these worked out. But the affiliations and the relationships were there, and they were there quite early on. Now, coming to the main thing I wanted to talk about, I wanted to focus on one particular text to give you an idea of what constitutes early Shi'i literature and what sort of themes it expresses in particular. And this happens also to be probably the earliest text, earliest written text in Islam, if you, of course, put the Quran to one side. And this is what's known as the Kitab al-Saqifa, or it's sometimes known as the Kitab Sulayb ibn Qais al-Hilali, named after the person who's supposed to have narrated it. There is very strong evidence that this was available in a written form, at least at the end of the first century, if not just after that. So what we would call the mid-Umayyad period, because the main person who transmits it as a book from Sulaym is a guy called Aban ibn Abi Ayyash, who is supposed to have been a companion of Imam Baqir. So we know it's from that point, at the very least, that this exists as a book. And it's a book which is known and attested, you know, through the centuries after that, continuously. And, of course, it did have people who disagreed with it, but on the whole, the vast majority of people agreed with it. There's only one case, actually, of an individual allegedly claiming that he thought this was a later fabrication. And even in that case, we really don't know whether this text, where the accusation of fabrication comes from, can be safely ascribed to that author. The author is Ibn al-Ghadairi in the 11th century, and in his work on the narrators and transmitters of the Imam, he says basically Sulaym really didn't exist, and this work is fabricated. But the scholarly consensus seems to be that the text which we have of Ibn al-Ghadairi is probably not the work of Ibn al-Ghadairi. So much so that the most famous bibliographer or bibliophile of the 20th century, Agha Bozorg Tehrani, has a very famous statement in which he says basically this work attributed to Ibn al-Ghadairi clearly cannot be his, because it contains within it doctrines which are clearly not Shi'i. And his own suspicion was that this was a Sunni fabrication produced in Baghdad in the 11th, probably 12th century, and then ascribed to a Shi'i author. But as I said, that's a debate. But the main point is that you only have one serious, one source which disputes the transmission of the text. It's quite possible that there are certain elements of the text which were later added to it. For example, there are actually probably three sections to the text. The entire text is made up of 98 reports, 98 hadith. Roughly half is the main text, then there's roughly another half which is sort of considered to be additions or what's sometimes called mustadaka, things which have been added on, which have similar types of provenance and then later collected. So certainly some of the hadith are probably a bit later, mainly because they have a very pronounced Ithna Ashari bent to it. And one assumes that in the first 150 or so years, it was probably unlikely to have a lot of material which was mentioning 12 Imams. But it's not impossible, but it was probably unlikely, given the provenance we have. But what it did have was a very clear statement about the walaya of the Imams, the status that they had, and of course the other important issue within it was bara'a or raft, or description of how the Imams basically were wronged. The Imams and of course Sayyidah Fatima Zahra alayhi salam were wronged. Now, I've picked out a few themes in these in the text, and I will mention them. I'm not sure if there's really that much time to go through it in a lot of detail, but I'll bring some of them up, and if you want, we can read through some of this. The text, and this is probably one of the reasons why the main title of the text is Kitab al-Saqifa. The text actually begins with five very long reports, which are about the passing of the Prophet, what happened at Saqifa, and the attack on the house of Imam Ali and Fatima Zahra, and the attempt at forcing him to give allegiance to Abu Bakr. That's what the first few narrations are about. And actually then, roughly halfway through, so the end of the first main section of the work, you have again a hadith on Saqifa, and then again towards the end you have another one. So it seems to be one of the important themes of the text of Saqifa. And it gives one the idea that in the early period for this nascent Shi'i community, what happened at Saqifa was absolutely fundamental. It was something which defined what they had been left out of. And it was something which was always going to define what they were. Because their affiliation was with Imam Ali, and Saqifa is fundamentally something which went against what he was, what his rights were. And an explicit line is drawn in this text, which is very interesting, between what happened at Saqifa and then what happens in Jamal and Safin, in the actual assassination of Imam Ali, and then of course in Karbala. So the echo is there already, and this gives you again an idea of how a certain chain of events, of the way in which the Ahlul Bayt have wronged, is absolutely fundamental to Shi'i thought. It's one of the reasons why I always find it quite ridiculous when some sort of so-called Shi'i reformists say that, you know, we're too obsessed with Karbala. They really don't understand the history. They don't understand that this obsession, if you want to call it that, is something which is very central to the tradition, always has been. And it's there in, you know, as I said, what is probably the earliest written work that we have, and certainly the earliest written work the world of Islam has either. So that's one very important theme which is there throughout. And alongside that, there are a number of themes which are about Imam Ali. One is this issue of ilm relating to the Quran. I'm sure you're all familiar with this famous hadith of the Prophet that you know, the Quran is with Ali and Ali is with the Quran. And there are a couple of quite long hadith in the Kitab Sulaim, the 10th and the 11th, in which, in the first one, someone actually asks him about this hadith and what it means. What does it mean for him to be with the Quran? And in the second one, quite interestingly, Talha, who then is later of Jamal infamy, comes and asks him that, I hear you have secluded yourself in your house to write down, to redact the Quran. So can you show it to me? And can you tell me what's in it and so forth? And there's a very long exchange on this particular theme, which again is about stressing the special relationship the imam has. And the special relationship is not just based on this hadith, but of course also goes back to the other very famous hadith that we have, the hadith of Thaqalain, about the relationship between the Qur'an and the Ahlul Bayt, which is also referred to this. So that's one aspect of the centrality of Imam Ali, which is in this text. The other one, there are many others which relate to virtues, excellences of the Imam, which are prominent. And in certain cases are about disputing those who come sort of in a sense against him. There's one exchange, for example, it's the 29th hadith, in which someone apparently says to him, yes, but you know, what about this famous report where the Prophet is supposed to have promised 10 people paradise? What's those who are known in the later Sunni tradition as the Ashra Mubashara, those who 10 people have been given the good news of paradise. And he basically says, look, there's no such hadith at all. There is no guarantee of paradise to these individuals. And he gives various reasons why this is the case as well. So part of it's also about disputing that. It's always, the text, as I said, is about where the association is, where the devotion is, where the attachment is, and also where the dissociation is. And there are roughly, I would say, a fifth to a quarter of the text is taken up with hadith about the treachery, the basic bad behavior, if you want to call it that, of Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman. It comes up again and again. And it starts, of course, with the fifth narration, which is the very long one about what happened after the passing of the Prophet. And again, I mean, some of the details, some of the language is early. One of the things we know, or at least one of the things that people who do hadith criticism often say, is that if a text is short and there's not long justifications, if the dialogue is quite clipped, it tends to be more early. Later texts tend to have all sorts of accretions about them, you know, long speeches and so forth, and extensive quotations of this and that. But if it's short and to the point, it's probably likely to be much earlier. And if the language sometimes is very much what you would expect from tribal language, we see that, for example, when you look at early historical texts like the Waqat Siffin, the language is very tribal. Again, this is an idea that it's quite likely to have a core which at least captures the meaning of what was being said. And you have this which going through a lot of these particular narrations which go around the case of Saqifa. And you have the very famous one where you know, the fire is lit at the door of the house, and you know, people expect, of course, Imam Ali to come out with a sword. He doesn't. And, you know, Omar says to Konfuth and the others, you know, grab him, take him away. We need to force him to pay allegiance. And Imam Ali says, these are roughly the words which are reported in that hadith. And there's another hadith which says the same thing, that if it were not for my concern for what I see for this community, and if it was not for the promise I gave the Prophet, I wouldn't leave you alive, and you know that. That's the exact words. And this is very striking, because often it's said, you know, why didn't the Imam do anything? Especially in Sunni polemics, you have this thing of saying, you know, come on, this is Ali al-Murtada. How was he going to stand by while his wife is being, you know, abused and his house is being burnt? And we have one report given here. There's another report which is related from Salman al-Farisi, which gives similar types of ideas. So already there's a notion of why the imam, in a sense, steps back and what the reason for this is. But also that at the heart of this is a very clear notion of who's responsible as well. And that's where the question of bara'a and raft comes in. And there's plenty of other examples of this. The final point I want to make about the text is that the majority of the material is early, in the sense that it's about what happens from when the Prophet is ill to the assassination of Imam Ali. That's the majority of the reports are from that period. But there are a few others, very few others, which are about Imam Hassan, his encounters with Muawiyah in particular. There's one very interesting hadith, which is supposed to be a conversation between Abdullah ibn Ja'far and Muawiyah. And there are two reports which are related to Karbala. So it certainly seems, as I said, the vast majority of the material is about that early period. And it's about establishing certain types of themes which were central to what the development of the Shi'i community was and Shi'i identity was in that. And just to repeat them, there's this fundamental centrality of the importance of the Ahlul Bayt, of Walaya, the importance of the inextricable link between the Ahlul Bayt and the Qur'an, and that this was a fundamental sort of foundation for how the question of ilm was understood, how the question of knowledge was understood. The flip side of that was a notion of dissociation, of keeping oneself away from and basically identifying the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. And so these are the two kind of central themes that one finds in that. And these then remain very much central themes, which are then taken up in various other types of texts in the classical period and beyond. For example, the other texts in which these are very striking are, for example, the early exegeses, those of Ali ibn Ibrahim, those of Ayyashi, Furat, even Hibari, which is, again, not an Ithnashari work, it's a Zaydi work. And even this tafsir, which is attributed to Imam al-Askari, it's almost definitely not his tafsir, but it certainly arises from that sort of period in the 4th century in Imami circles. So it's as I said, it's something which is very much there, and it raises all sorts of issues. One last theme I'll just quickly mention, and this will perhaps lead on to the next sessions, is about the nature of argumentation. You already get the beginnings of quite simple forms of argumentation in some of these texts, which are then developed, of course, in theological and philosophical texts much later. You know, certain types of reasoning is given for why this is the case. And I do know of at least one specialist on early works who's tried to, for example, translate hadith into logical syllogisms and see how you can see the logical structure of what's going on in certain hadith. But again, you can see some very nascent examples of this in these sorts of texts as well, in terms of how argumentation works. It's not just always rather earthy, a tribal language, but there's something a bit more to that, because ultimately there's a claim being made. There's a fundamental claim being made, and that claim requires some elements of justification. And so there is a form of argumentation which was required to convey that. So I think I will stop at that point.
Thank you, Professor Rizvi. We'll now open the floor to question and answers. So if anyone's got any questions, please raise your hand.
Thank you very much for your talk.
Okay.
I have three questions, actually. The first is, you mentioned that there was a Shi'i consensus on Kitab al-Saqifa. What is opinion beyond the Shi'i community, as in amongst Western historians or amongst the Ahl al-Sunnah on it? My second question relates to the way in which you talk about Kitab al-Saqifa as a rudimentary expression of early Shi'i theology and a Shi'i identity. To what extent is this the compiler's presentation of what he understands to be Shi'i theology or the nature of the Imamah? And as in an early Shi'ism, as in through what some of the Orientalists have written about, you see people switching sides constantly. To what extent is actually this very much an individual work rather than a reflection of, you know, real society during the early period? And the third question I have is, to what extent is this text theological and to what extent is it political? And is there a certain kind of, is it a balance? Is it very much the same thing? Or is it something that clearly has a very, you know, very particular slant?
Okay, I'll take your last one first. I personally don't think, if you asked anyone in the first, say, three centuries, were they writing a theological or political text, they wouldn't really understand the question. I don't think they're very clear demarcations. And in fact, the earlier you go, it's very difficult to pinpoint the genre of a text. So something like the Kitab al-Saqifa is divided into sections, which is called hadith. And that's almost definitely a much later term, which is then used to divide the sections. But some of them are exegetical. You know, some of them are, you know, people asking about particular Quranic verses. Some of them are on little points of law at times. There's not very much of that material. Not so much points of law, but points about practice, I'd say. And a lot of it is also about the nature of, fundamentally, of the early history, because the early history then defines the theology. It defines various positions in the theology. So, you know, generally, I don't think it's easy to make that sort of distinction between theology and politics in the early period. What do others think of it? You can imagine what the Sunni Rijalis thought of it, given that there are very frank statements given about Omar in particular. The fact that he is described as accursed, the fact that he is described as being punished more severely in the afterlife than the devil, the fact that, you know, various other, the early figures who were the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt are described in these terms. So they clearly had a problem with it, but they also had a problem with written transmission. So for them, the issue doesn't even arise. There's written transmission, and then, of course, it's transmitted by the Shia. So it has to be rejected anyway. It's very rare to find a Sunni Rijali from the classical period saying anything good about a Shi'i narrator or about a Shi'i text. It's very rare. The only examples from the 11th, 12th century are people like Khatib Baghdadi, who sometimes is kind of fairly scholarly and his assessment of people, and even Ibn Asakir. But apart from them, most of them basically, if a transmitter is accused of raft, then basically what he has to say is doesn't matter because he's a liar anyway. For me, that doesn't really matter. It's of absolutely no relevance what a Sunni Rijali from the 4th, 5th century says. As far as academics are concerned, there are two or three academics who have written on this. Patricia Kroner has argued that a lot of the work clearly reflects Shi'i ideas, Shi'i doctrine, Shi'i identity, but it's not always clear that it's an exclusive Husseini and then what becomes Ithna Ashari. In fact, her argument is because a lot of the material is just about Imam Ali, you know, this could also have come out of circles who might have been sort of what are called Hashimi Shia. It could also have been associated with circles who had survived the revolt of Mukhtar. And some of this material might have come out of those sort of circles. But it's certainly Shia material. A few others, someone like Muhammad Ali Amir Mirzi, his position I think is pretty much my position, which is that it definitely does reflect Shia identity and Shia doctrines. And if you then compare it with other texts, the sort of texts which I've mentioned in the handout, in a corroborating manner, then you can pretty much find everything which is in the Kitab al-Saqifa and these other works as well, in terms of the themes. Sometimes not necessarily the same wording, but you can find pretty much all the themes in other texts. So there's plenty of corroboration in other types of early texts, which suggests that this is pretty much what it meant to be Shi, broadly speaking, in the early period. There's always, as I said, going to be a few things which are disputed in the margins. But some of the core ideas which I stressed, walaya, the question of ilm, and bara, are very much central, and they're not disputed. On just one thing about switching sides, well, that kind of fits within this. And that's also one of the reasons why I was suggesting that it's useful sometimes to look at the Zaydi and the Ismaili material as well, because you find similar types of texts going on. You sometimes find them amongst the Ahl al-Hadith, the Sunni Ahl al-Hadith, but it's increasingly rare. Because one of the fundamental problems the Sunni Ahl al-Hadith had, primarily the Hanbalis, but broadly those who were associated with the circles, is that they didn't recognize Imam Ali as a caliph until quite late. So they were not really much inclined to promoting or transmitting material which was in favor of him.
Any more questions?
Question. You mentioned that there were 400 roughly works of companions, of which only 20 exist. Do we know what happened to the other books?
That's precisely the issue, is were there 400? You know, my point is that there was written transmission, and that there were works which were written down much earlier than Al-Kafi, or even before Basair and Mahasin and so forth. There are other usul which are named. I've given the references. If you look at Ibn Tawus, if you look at the Fihrist of Ibn Nadim, if you look at the Fihrist of Sheikh Tusi and others, you find names of usul which have not survived. And basically, for a certain period in the 10th, 11th century, Baghdad was a very dangerous place. Nothing's changed. Shia houses where they had libraries like Sheikh Mufid's, they were constantly being sacked and burnt, you know, by the traditionalist mobs. So for works to be lost was not that difficult, really, given that, you know, certain places like Baghdad were real centers in terms of centers of learning. Of course, you had communities in other places, but there's not very much evidence of people writing down things apart from Kufa, Baghdad, and Qom. So, you know, libraries were being burnt all the time. Texts were being lost. But even then, I think if you look at all these Fahadis, you still wouldn't find the name of 400. But it's more like the idea, it's kind of symbolic. The idea is that, you know, the tradition produced work and it's been lost, and that there was written transmission.
Could you just explain a little bit further about the differences around the
oral and written transmission between the Sunnis and Shi'i. In a sense, what's at the root of the difference? And then secondly, at what point did, if at all, the Sunnis then move towards a written transmission? Or what circumstances changed?
Well, on the Sunni side, what I told you before was pretty much kind of the position, which is that there was a need to start to write and codify things because the communities had expanded greatly and there was a need to protect ilm from what was not ilm. And then that was partly a concern, supposedly, with protecting the legacy of the Prophet, although it's not about the legacy of the Prophet, it's about a bit more than that. Written transmission has never been acceptable in a Sunni context. Written works are always, they have to still be orally transmitted. And this is definitely the case in hadith contexts. And broadly speaking, even within our tradition, the oral transmission is still preferable. You know, the old-fashioned muhaddithin still want you to know the stuff, you know, it's got to be in your head. And if you don't know it, then, you know, you can't just look it up. You can't Google it. Or you can't use a CD-ROM. You won't get an ijazah if you've got a CD-ROM. So there's still a preferable thing. But certainly within Sunni circles, the idea of written transmission was never acceptable. And the amount of hadith condemning, or hadith in a wider sense, because of course it's also what the companions are saying, condemning something being written and then transmitted, just, you know, someone handing a book over, is pretty clear. Now, one of the arguments, one of the standard academic arguments about the prohibition of writing is that this is kind of like a cover-up. It's covering up the fact that material has been cobbled together from here and there and everywhere. And it's about basically not revealing your sources. I am not entirely convinced by that, because some of those arguments about external influences, you know, from Jewish law, from Samaritan law and so forth, there's still a lot more evidence which needs to go into that. And that's partly because we just still don't have very much which has survived from that late antique period in this, the actual context in which these works were being produced. There is still, that's still not entirely an acceptable objection to that. But certainly within the Shia tradition, as I mentioned before, there are also these hadith which praise people writing things down so you don't forget. As I said, there's a whole bab in Al-Kafi on that.
Sorry, if I just can come in. So maybe I didn't understand, but is there a when you, there's an objection to the written transmission,
yeah.
But is that objection, was it politically driven? Was it socially driven? Was it theologically driven? And then why is there the difference?
The standard argument is that in the earlier period, there was a prohibition on writing down hadith in particular because they wanted to keep the distinction between hadith and Quran, right? So that's arguably a theological argument. But it then begs the question of how could you have confused the two, given that the theological status of hadith, or certainly the sunnah, seems to have been quite clear. There's evidence that people understood what sunnah meant like 30 years 20 years after the Prophet. And people understood what the Qur'an meant as an act of revelation. But officially, that's one of the arguments, is that it was to protect the uniqueness of the Qur'an as something which is quite distinct. But that still begs the question also, something I didn't get into, which is, what do we mean by the Qur'an? And that's a whole can of worms, which I'd rather not go into right now.
Any questions from the ladies' side?
Another question. Very early on in your lecture, you mentioned that the common view the Shia have, or some Shias have, is that the Imams were sinless. and you made a distinction that the word in Arabic slightly differs to the English definition. Is it possible if you can expand upon that?
The thing is, the word is translated in different ways. It's translated as inerrant, it's translated as sinless, it's translated as infallible. Now, people have a big problem with this word infallible. I personally don't have a problem with the word infallible, but then I have a maximalist reading of what Asma means. The question is always, what is the scope of it? Does it mean that there is some sort of miraculous holding back? You know, that's the prophet or the imam is being restrained from doing something, so he clearly has both the will and the ability to do something which is not right, a sinful act. Does it even extend to this whole question of does Isma go into areas which are strictly speaking non-religious? What again depends on what that means, and certainly Sunnis have no problem with that because they have the classic, you know, examples of the prophet and the farmer, you know, and the prophet apparently gives the farmer some bad advice and the crops don't turn out exactly the way they should and so forth. And so this is an example that, you know, Isma has a certain constraint in that particular direction. But as I said, it's not just a question of translation, it's a question of how far you see that scope going. And that is a point on which you could have an argument, you could have differences, but at the very least, the notion that whatever the Prophet conveyed and whatever he did in his role as a guide, as a person who was bringing the faith, telling people about the faith, and then the role that the imams had in perpetuating that, there has to be a guarantee, and we'll come to this next time when we look at some of the theological arguments, there has to be a guarantee that is flawless. Because if it's not flawless, you have a problem of how you can trust the sources. How can you trust that teaching if it's not, if it's fallible in some way, if it might be mistaken? Basically, how can you trust a liar to bring it down to its basic core? And that's where it becomes problematic. But, it's sometimes it's really silly. You know, like one chap who would certainly describe himself as a reformer said to me once, so does that mean that every single proposition that an imam utters has to be true? And I said to him, first of all, the imam doesn't utter propositions. He's not a logician. That's just not the way it works. You know, to translate everything into some sort of rather cold logical language doesn't work. That's not the way it doesn't work at all. And it raises whole sorts of questions about truth validity. And what do you mean by truth anyway? And what do you expect of the imam? Ultimately, it comes down to the status of the imam. Do you think the imam is, you know, one of the, as the reformist mantra is, ulama abrar? Or do you think he's wajhullah? That's the stark contrast. And I think it's obvious where I lie in that. So.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll end there today.